again, good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, April the 10th, 2018, 12 and a half p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're tuned into the Now program. Scott Spears along with you for the ride. Now, we have got a great program today. So just tear the knob off your radio or the button or whatever you use because you will want to stick with us today. Going to do some quick housekeeping here before we get to today's program. Mary Ellen Withrow, 40th Treasurer of the United States, called in yesterday, and we want to remind people that she is having an open house at Primrose this coming Sunday, April the 15th, Tax Day, 2 to 4 p.m. So Mary Ellen Withrow, 40th Treasurer of the United States, open house, 2 to 4 p.m., April the 15th, Sunday, at Primrose here in Marion. Her museum is out there. It's amazing. I visited it Christmas Eve. I've been through it a couple times. It's well worth the trip. And Mary Ellen will be there, and you can ask her questions about things that you see. So 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday. Also want to remind you, the governor's race is heating up. Less than 30 days now before our primary here in Ohio for governor. And to that, next Tuesday, a week from today, on April the 17th, Dennis Kucinich, former Fox News analyst, former representative here in Ohio, will be live in studio from 5:10 to 6 p.m. Now, during that time period, during our interview for the hour, you will be able to call in and ask him questions at 740-383-9944. If you would like to submit a question for Representative Kucinich to be asked during that time, send a message to Scott at WWGH1071.com. Dennis Kucinich, really the front runner on the Democratic side with Rich Cordray for governor. He'll be here next Tuesday, 5:10 to 6 p.m. We want to thank our guest yesterday because we did not get a chance to do that. Clarence Jones was on, Martin Luther King Jr.'s attorney, speechwriter, and friend, commemorating the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination yesterday. We thank Clarence Jones and Pat Buchanan for being on yesterday. Pat Buchanan, very interesting man, first time he'd been on this program, and we only had Pat for about 11 minutes yesterday because of the Clarence Jones interview running over, so hopefully we're trying to work it out where Pat Buchanan will be on Thursday at 1:10 to 2 p.m. for the hour, so hopefully we will get that done. Now, coming up at 1 o'clock today, we've got Stephen B. Jacobs. Now, you might not recognize that name, but if you pick up Newsweek this week, you will find a headline. It's a quote: "I'm a Holocaust survivor. Trump's America feels like Germany before Nazis took over." Stephen B. Jacobs is the man who made that statement to Newsweek. He's an architect in New York, and he knows President Trump very well. He will be on to explain that quote, which got national attention yesterday, and his relationship with President Trump next hour. So you won't want to miss that. Now, amid all that, we've got a great guest this hour. I am always thrilled when he comes on. He's an author. The book that here in Marion we were certainly most interested in is The Harding Affair, which chronicles the relationship between Carrie Phillips and President Harding. And I wanted to have Jim back on, Jim Robinault's the guest, because we've been talking a lot over the last few days about these letters and the fact that President Harding did have a mistress, and President Trump, our current president, also seems to have some, do you still call them mistresses? I don't know. But he has his peccadilloes as well. And also, Harding's people kind of ran away with the store. President Trump, I don't know what the situation there. So let's bring Jim Robinault in to help us solve all that. Jim, how are you?
Great, Scott. Nice to talk to you.
It's always good to talk with you. Before we get into President Harding, I did want to ask you, being a lawyer, what did you make of the raid yesterday on Michael Cohen's offices?
It's interesting. It is being run out of New York. in the office up there. So it's I'm not sure exactly how it all ties together with what the special prosecutor is doing, but it is, you know, it's interesting to us lawyers for a lot of reasons, the main one being, you know, that the attorney-client privilege is supposed to be sacrosanct, except, and there are exceptions, and that's what John Dean and I go around the country talking about, is what are those exceptions when the attorney-client privilege is not going to be honored? You know, it's there's a lot there to unpack.
The thing that was most interesting to me yesterday was, I think last week or the week before, I saw an article that said that Mueller had said that Trump was not being investigated, that the election was being investigated, but Trump was not under investigation. Well, to raid his lawyer's office like this, or to send it over to the New York attorney, I would think it would have to do something with Trump.
Yeah, no. And what he said technically is that Trump is a
subject
in the investigation, which is higher than not being investigated. He's not a target, which is, you know, when you're told, look, we're looking into you. But subject is up there, so it's part of that. But from everything that I've read, what appears to be going on is the question of whether or not this lawyer is in hot water for the way he moved money around with this porn star and this entity that created, and whether he was lying to banks about what he did. And it's a very, to most people, esoteric question about money and money laundering and that sort of stuff. But it's a serious charge, and I think that seems to be what they're about.
You know, when we get all these people, offices raided and indictments, the only connection that, say, a Michael Flynn, a Paul Manafort, a Cohen seem to have in common is President Trump. Is there any way that no charges get brought against President Trump, but all his people get raided and indicted and make plea deals?
Well, the way this works and the way it worked in Watergate is you start with people on the periphery and you start to put pressure on them, and you do that by bringing charges against them that will stick and that will be a threat to them and to their freedom and liberty. And it's not like you're doing this unfairly. These people usually are involved in things that are criminal activities, and there's a high suspicion. And for example, the raid yesterday had to be approved by a court. So there's some serious evidence they have that there was reason to believe not only that there was some crime going on, but that you have this extra level of attorney-client privilege that a court would have to think very seriously about. And one of the exceptions to the attorney-client privilege is called the crime fraud exception. So there had to be some serious evidence for a court to allow this to happen. And what happens then, you start putting pressure on all these people who are around, you see what you find with them, but then what you're ultimately doing is getting them to what prosecutors would call flip, so that they, in return for cooperation, so that they have a lesser penalty that they face, you know, they start providing information that, you know, takes people higher and higher towards Trump. So there's no question that that's what's going on here. This pressure is being applied because they really want to find out the truth about what happened in the election, and I think they're looking every which way they can to get that information, and it clearly is pointed at Trump.
Mm. It's going to be interesting to see where this all goes, and obviously the big story as of late has been Stormy Daniels, and here in Marion, that made us think back to President Harding. Now, an interesting question was brought up the other day, because President Harding came from media. He came from the Marion Star. He, Lieutenant Governor, Senator, President. The letters that you have went through, why do you think he wrote those? Because certainly those were evidence that he did have the affair.
Right. You know, that's a great question. And as I was going through the 900 pages, and, you know, I had to transcribe them and have some people actually help me transcribe them, what comes up every now and then is his statement that he knows these are dangerous letters, and he often asked her to destroy them. But he also, you know, he was one of those guys who kind of, got a thrill out of living in on the edge a little bit. There was obviously these affairs were doing that, but writing these letters was also doing that. And I think there was probably, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I think there was a part of him that wanted to be discovered. I think he was in a very unhappy marriage, and I think he really thought that he would be happier with Carrie Phillips. But it just was, all the circumstances would not allow it. And you know, part of him talked also about hoping for the day he'd get out of public office and the two of them could go off to a farm together and live this this wonderful life. So he was a risk taker, and especially when it came to love and so forth. And so it really was quite dangerous what he was doing.
Interestingly enough, the question always comes up, did Florence know that he was having affairs?
Yes, I'm convinced of it. There is a letter in the collection from an attorney in Columbus, Ohio, who meets with Jim and Warren and Carrie and Florence, and they all have it out. The letter is written it's written to Carrie from this lawyer, but it really, and it's kind of written obtusely on purpose, but you can read between the lines about who was in the meeting and what was being said. And I think there was this come to Jesus moment. It was in 1916 when there was a confrontation about all of it. So, and I think that Florence knew that he was also someone who was not to be trusted in terms of his fidelity, just overall. And frankly, I think a lot of political wives and spouses and now men, I think they kind of recognize that's one of the dangers of the territory. And you know, it kind of goes with wanting fame and wanting attention. There's a hole in these people that needs to be filled, and part of it, you know, sometimes is filled with affairs and through sex. So I mean, it's not unusual. I mean, we just celebrated and commemorated Martin Luther King, but you know, he had affairs, and he told his wife about it not long before he died, you know. You know, it kind of goes with the territory of people who are powerful, looking for attention, and traveling a lot. And I just think the spouses aren't stupid. I think they know what happens, and they learn to live with it.
Why do you, this is just kind of an off question, but I think because she ran for president, why is Hillary Clinton, do you think, the one spouse who was cheated on, who people, instead of blaming the person, blame the spouse? I mean, they don't blame Coretta Scott King, they don't blame Florence Harding,
right?
But they use that against Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, well, everything about Hillary is toxic. I mean, and it's, I voted for her, but I understand why there's a toxicity to her, too, to people. Now, part of it has been truly manufactured. She's been attacked viciously, and part of that viciousness is the Clintons. Part of it is she's a woman running for office. We've never had a female president. Part of, you know, there's a whole mix of reasons why it's been so toxic and so vicious, but in a sense, the Clintons kind of brought this on themselves by the one problem, you know, there's a lot of good to them. There was and there are a lot of things I like about them. But one of their problems was they were elitist about a lot of things, you know, Yale Law School, that sort of thing. And I think that elitism just really rubbed people the wrong way. And in her case, it really rubbed people the wrong way, because she seemed that what people feel is that people like that are hypocrites. You know, here they're talking for the common man, but they really don't live their lives like that. So, I mean, it's a huge, big story, but I think with her, it's just everything is toxic, and so she's going to be blamed not only for her own problems, but for Bill's being a jerk about what he did.
What was the range of the affair between President Harding and Carrie Phillips?
Well, it starts in 1905, and it starts at an interesting point. It starts when Florence has had surgery, and that's that's one of the underlying themes of all of this. She had a bad kidney, and she was constantly sick as a result of it, and he was convinced, as was his brother who was a doctor, that Florence wasn't going to live a long life. And I think part of the reason he at times wanted to leave her but didn't, because he just, you know, he actually says it, you know, I couldn't do this when she was in this state. of health. So 1905, she has some surgery, and imagine what surgery was like back then, Scott, in 1905. And so she is laid up, and Jim Phillips is mourning the death of their son, their only son, who was, I think, about 2 years old when he died. He goes to Battle Creek Sanitarium at Warren's suggestion, and it's during that time where both of their spouses are indisposed that they spark their relationship. And so it starts there and then goes all the way through to, obviously, the 1919 and 1920 when he starts running for president. And the rift really comes with the war and so forth. But they continue to have some contact right through the time of his death. I mean, she was still in contact with him through 1923. So 1905 to 1923 is the answer.
When do you believe, or can we ascertain, the last sexual encounter happened?
First of all, in 1917, you know, she was clearly this German, I call her a German spy. I think there's a ton of evidence that she was, if not just a very high German sympathizer. But they have this series of letters that are really extraordinary on arguing about whether the United States should get involved in the war. And they clearly have a fracture in the relationship, and that is when Nan Britton comes into the picture. And why she comes into the picture, frankly, it's this fracture over the war. It's no coincidence that their relationship starts up in May of 1917. So I think he's got that relationship going on. But it's also clear that after that point, there's a bit of a coming back together between Warren and Kerry. And I would guess on into 1919, they're still having a sexual affair.
The German spy thing is a big part of this. Now, by German spy, what do you mean?
Well, what was going on back then was that the Germans were trying to get people who were sympathetic to their cause in the United States to provide information about the United States. And in particular, they wanted to know how fast the United States was getting ready to come into the conflict. We declare war in April of 1917. The war had been going on for many years. But Woodrow Wilson says, I'm not going to send troops, you know, 20,000 at a time. We're going to build up a million-man army. We're going to send them over towards the end of the year when they're all ready. And so that was what they wanted to know, was how quickly were people getting ready and how quickly was the mobilization happening. And so there was tons of evidence that there were women spies who went to the camps where the men had been drafted, were training, and would go to dances with them and parties with them and talk about things. This is what the Baroness Zollner was doing down in Tennessee when she was arrested for espionage. And so Kerry and Isabel are outside of a camp up in New York. Camp Upton was the name of it. And they were there right when the camp opened, and they were there for 3 or 4 weeks. Port Jefferson, New York, Long Island, and there is no reason in the world for two women from Marion, Ohio to be there other than the fact that they're trying to get information and going to dances and all the rest of that stuff. And the reason they're there is that Kerry's daughter, Isabel, becomes engaged to a guy who is one of the guys whose fleet is up there too. So that's, you know, and then, of course, the evidence that we have that they were spying is that they were being told this by a lot of the intelligence units who were watching them were being told that they were saying very pro-German things and all that sort of stuff. So there's a real substantial amount of evidence about it.
Why Kerry Phillips? Why does she decide to do this?
Well, Kerry was very proud of her German heritage, as are a lot of people in that part of the state of Ohio. That was my heritage, too. The Robinaud family is German. And, you know, my grandmother had a German Bible, and a lot of people over there, there's a high concentration of German immigrants. She had some, and then that was part of her fascination with Germany that took her there in 1911, September of 1911, she took Isabel to Berlin to get her educated. And so they were in this imperial city that was, you know, the height of Berlin at its time. You know, the Kaiser and military power, and you know, the German nation had been born about 20 or 30 years earlier, and it was really this fantastic growth period, but it was also militaristic. And she liked that. She went over there, and she ended up staying, as you know, through the summer of 1914, right before the war broke out, is when she came back. So she became very enamored with the German ethic and came back very much pro-German and anti-English and all anti-French. And so she was a real pro-German from that experience.
Now, after this, she starts having the affair with President Harding, who was a senator at the time. Or he was still in Marion when the thing started. Was that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, what information is she trying to get from him? Is she trying to get any information from him now that he's in Washington?
Very good question. And that's raised in a lot of these intelligence reports. There's a lot of question about whether or not she is getting some advance information from him. And I just don't know. I mean, I don't know if that happened or not, but I do know that he was circumspect with her in the sense that these letters that they wrote about when we were about to get involved in the war, he kind of laid it out and said, I'm not with you on this, and if it means the end of our relationship, it means the end of our relationship, and I'm going to vote for war eventually, he says. So I think that he was someone who would put his country above a love interest, and I don't know how much, I forget what committees he was on, I don't know how much advanced knowledge he had about what was going on anyway that wasn't in the newspaper, because Wilson held a lot of stuff close to his vest, as you know, that's the way he was. So I'm not so sure that a senator would know that much more than anybody in the, you know, reading the newspapers at the time.
What is the indication that President Harding knew Carrie Phillips was a German spy?
Because in 1918, when the trap is about to get her, she is really being followed, and they are, you know, the Army intelligence write a letter to him. Imagine that, to a senator, about, tell us about this woman. And he writes a letter back saying, oh, she's a great person, no problem, don't worry about her and all that. And then he turns right around and writes her a letter and says, whatever you're doing, stop it. And then when he doesn't hear from her, he writes to Jim and says, whatever she's doing, stop it. You know, this is very dangerous stuff, war is hell, people get shot for this sort of thing. So that was kind of the moment, I think, when the light bulb went on with him that she was doing something behind the scenes that he really didn't know about, but he told her to knock it off.
You know, that's interesting because, you know, we, like I said, some people have their picadillos, and they, maybe he liked living dangerously, but when he's contacted by the American government, we know because of this letter that he knows, he lies to the government, so, oh, she's a nice person and all this sort of thing, and then sends a letter to her and says, knock it off, and he's a sitting senator.
Right.
What would we call that?
Well, you know, the time was extremely complex because that war, World War I, was, nobody was without blood on their hands. And I write this in the Harding affair too. The Great Britain had a illegal blockade because they had this navy, and it was unlawful the way they were doing it under international law, and so the Germans had reason to have their U-boats, you know, get involved on the other side, and both of them, I just had blood on their hands, and the whole contest and how it started and what it was about and what it ended up being about was very complicated. So people in the United States had really strong feelings one way or the other about it. It wasn't like we were just this wasn't like World War II, where Germany was clearly totally wrong and evil. It was, everybody was kind of sharing the blame in Europe for the First World War. It was an imperial war, you know, among these imperial powers. And so people who were German and of German extraction felt very strongly that their country should be the one that we support. And we don't look at it that way looking back because we ended up supporting the Allies. But so I think in his case, he felt that she was probably supporting what she thought was right, and not that she was being a traitor to her country. So I think that, you know, it's not as easy to say that she was totally wrong and he should have known it. I think it's a really more nuanced, complex question.
There were a lot of flaps to this relationship, because if you start with just the affair, you have the affair, and the spouses probably didn't know when it started. Then you have the flap of her starting to do some German spy activity, but he knows about that, so he's one up on her. Then, you know, they're questioning him. The U.S. government's questioning him as a senator. He's lying about it. He sends her a letter, says knock it off. But yet she never destroys the letters like he asked her to do.
Right.
Why do you think she didn't?
Oh, I think it was insurance. Yeah. I think she kept them to keep everybody at bay. She was an odd person in some ways. She had a very strong personality, but you know, by the end of her life, she was very eccentric. You know, with these German dogs, and you know, taking over her house, and there's clearly something very eccentric about her and wrong at the end of her life. But she always had this high personality, and I think that she was paranoid that authorities were going to arrest her for her activities all the way through, you know, the Second World War. And so I think she kept them so that if, you know, as kind of leverage in the event anybody would ever come after her. I also, that's in the main what I think. I also think she kept him because she really loved him, and she wanted to keep these things as remembrances of him after he died. And she clearly went back and, like, marked them up after he was dead, and she went through them. And so I think it was partly the insurance, partly just that she had loved him and wanted to remember him.
Even in the early 1900s, wouldn't there have been a better way to do this instead of, here's a love note, very explicit, destroy it as soon as you read it?
Would there have been a better way to do it?
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously getting together at points.
Oh, yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that's an era that's totally lost to us. You know, we now do email. We do two sentences, and that's it. But back then, letter writing had a really important function in the world and in people's relationships, because it was the only, you know, there wasn't really telephone communication until a little bit later, and even that was hard and expensive and all that. And letters were the main way that people, you know, it was a huge part of people's relationships, and it was a huge part of how people kind of worked through their lives to figure out, you know, what they were thinking and their emotions and all the rest of that stuff. So it was a big deal, and I think his letter writing to her was an extremely important outlet for him. You know, he was doing a lot of other stuff, a lot of other pressure, a lot of stress with the newspaper and then with his public life. And this was his recreation. And these letters are his recreation, and they're sexual recreation. So I think the letter writing itself was an experience that was important beyond the actual physical experiences they had together.
What is interesting to me is that he becomes a senator. World War I is going on. Intelligence is following her, or at least they're keeping tabs on her because they believe she's doing this. But the affair doesn't end until 1919. Didn't they see them? Did the intelligence know they were having an affair?
Oh, yeah. Not only them. The Attorney General of the United States knew it. Woodrow Wilson probably knew it. Clearly, there are memos from the Bureau of Investigation, which is the precursor to the FBI. The guy at the time, who was the J. Edgar Hoover of his day, wrote a long memo to the Attorney General, a guy named Thomas Watts, about Harding's affair with her, and the fact that she was pro-German, and the fact that Jim Phillips was pro-German, and how at the moment they didn't have enough evidence to go after them, but once they put in the Sedition Act in 1918, they would. Which, you know, didn't allow you to advocate. So it was very well known, and I, at the end of my book, conclude that everybody dropped it, including the Democrats, because they just, you know, they didn't see the point in it. The war ended. Everybody was ready to forget that. And I think the people high up in the Wilson administration just understood that Warren Harding was likely to be the next president, and I just don't think they wanted to get crosswise with him.
Wouldn't that, though, have prevented him from becoming the next president if the Democrats had brought that out after he became the nominee?
I would think so. But, you know, on the other hand, Grover Cleveland admitted to having an affair with a woman who had a kid that he never adopted and didn't marry her. And one of the, and you can go back and look at this, there's some wah, where's my paw or something like that was, you know, I mean, it was in the presidential election. They talked about it. And so, I mean, some people can look past that. I think the problem with her was not just the affair, but the German aspect. That I think that would have been a disqualifying thing for him.
All that being said, you say you think the sexual part of it ended in 1919, but the relationship never did end until his death in 1923. Knowing all this, once he becomes president, they're no longer having the affair. Why continue to speak with her?
I think it was just episodic. I don't think it was regular contact. And I think, I said it in the book, and I still believe it, that this was the love of his life. I don't think Nan Britton was, and I don't think that Florence was. I think this woman he connected with in some very unusual way, and I think I'm sure he missed her, and I'm sure that, you know, that was a part of a sadness in his life that the two of them never got together. So I think there's even one point where she comes to the White House to visit with him, but I think, you know, and remember, she also, the evidence seems to suggest he was paying her to be quiet. You know, that right at the end she threatened him, and he offered to give her like $5,000 a year until he was out of public office. I think that happened. So I think that part of the relationship was going on too, the blackmail part.
So there are runs like this. President Trump is not immune.
He's not the first.
Not the first.
If you're watching the Kennedy stuff, I mean, Kennedy was three times reckless. With what he was doing. I mean, he's having a relationship with a woman who was having a relationship with a mob figure. I mean, it's just as I say, Scott, the more I look at this, the more I read history, it goes with the territory. It's part of the makeup of someone who wants to be in public office.
Now, this is what's fascinating to me, that they stayed in touch until he died. Now, at some point, the Nan Britton thing happens, and 100 years later now, we know that there was a child produced out of this. Did Carrie Phillips know about that, in your best guess?
I don't see any evidence that she knew about Nan Britton. I don't know is the answer, but I don't remember coming across any evidence that she knew about Nan Britton, and I was looking closely for it.
Well, go ahead.
Well, you know, there are just times where they almost overlap with him and seeing each other. That's one of the reasons I discounted Nan Britton, because it just seemed like, man, that's a pretty close call, with him being with both of them at, you know, within days or months, you know, and that somehow she would know about it. But I didn't see any evidence she knew about it. And I don't know whether Nan knew that he was continuing with Carrie. I think Nan knew because she was a neighbor, that he was having an affair with her, but I don't know if he knew if they talked about it, or if she knew that it had been stopped because of the war, or whatever. It's not clear.
Now, we do know that Carrie Phillips obviously did not destroy her letters. Do you believe that Nan Britton did, or are they still out there somewhere?
Now, you'd have to ask Jim, what's his last name?
Oh, Blessing?
Jim. Yeah, Jim Blessing.
Yeah,
he may have a stash of stuff, and I think they've got materials. That's what I went out and visited with Peter Harding about a month ago in Big Sur, and he is a stitch. He lives on this property that is some of the most beautiful property in the world, that he bought like in 1960 for nothing. And we were talking about this. He's the guy that insisted on doing the DNA after he read my book, and is in touch with Jim Blessing pretty regularly now. And I think that Blessing is an interesting guy. He doesn't like me because I discounted his mother's relationship. But I do think they have stuff, and I think I don't know if they have anybody who really knows what they're looking at going through any of it.
Well, you know, he came on, he's come on here quite a few times, and I think it's really the only media he's done, and he's a fascinating guy. He says grandma's right, and he's glad she's being proven,
yep.
Which is nice, I guess, for him and his family.
Yeah. He looks like Warren Harding, too.
He does. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You'd be hard to miss that one.
It
absolutely would. Now, here's the peculiar thing. Now, President Harding dies in 1923. Now, Nan Britton, because of anger and I think money issues, writes The President's Daughter, the really first tell-all book. Now, that's published in 1927, but she gets in trouble over this. I mean, there are lawyers suing her, trying to stop publication and saying all kinds of nasty things about her. Carrie Phillips didn't die until 1960. Why didn't she come forward? She could have made some money, too. She had the letters.
Yeah, I know. And there is, now you're testing my memory. There's some indication that Carrie said something about her relationship with Harding when the Nan Britton stuff came out, but that she kind of held her counsel. I think she had somewhat of a paranoid streak because of all this stuff during the First World War and the fact that she eventually found out she was being followed by the government. I think once you're followed by the government, it never leaves you. And I think she was always probably tentative about all this stuff. So I think she wanted to just leave it alone and not stir the pot.
Do you think the Harding family always knew?
About her?
About...
Or about Nan?
The whole thing. Both of them.
I think the Harding family probably had very mixed emotions about Nan, but I think they tended to discount her. And so I don't think that they, in good faith, just ignored her. I think they tended to discount her. But I also think there's a strain in that family that wondered, including Peter. I think on the Carrie Phillips end, my guess is that they all probably knew about that affair. I mean, I think that was his brother and sisters had to have known about that relationship and that it was something that he was deeply involved in. So the first time I ever talked with Warren Harding III about it, he just said, "We think this is all personal and a family matter and it's nobody's business," kind of. So I think that's the way they approached it all is, this is just, you know, everybody's entitled to their personal life, even if they're politicians.
You know, the fascinating thing, and I think one of the reasons that Nan Britton was discounted through her entire life was when this trial happens, when she writes this book, and they're saying, well, now, wait a second, that's all a lie, she could never produce any of these letters or any proof that it did happen. I would imagine he wrote her letters. She says she destroyed them. I do know that.
Right.
Why do you think she did and Carrie didn't? Carrie's using insurance and Nan is just too young, maybe?
Yeah, and Nan is very young and very naive. And I think she thought that once she got pregnant and had his daughter that things were going to go her way once he was out of the presidency. So I think he did whatever he asked her to do. I think she did whatever he asked her to do. I think Carrie was much older, much more mature, and much more aware of herself in the world and what was going on in the world and how she was being, you know, monitored.
When your book came out, I thought it was very pivotal because I think we all knew, it was probably 70-30, we believe the Carrie Phillips affair. Up until that, really, there was no proof that he actually did have affairs. We all thought he did because of Nan Britton and Carrie Phillips' letters, but we never saw it. So the book comes out. But then I think we all kind of thought, well, hey, maybe he's kind of a smart guy because he does know that she's involved, and she's involved in this German thing, and this was a long relationship, and maybe he just, you know, he loved her, as you said. That's the love of his life. But we now know that he also had a relationship with Nan Britton. Do you think there were other women, too?
I used to say no, and I now would say yes. I just think it was not only this political thing I keep talking about, which I think continues today, but I think back at the time it was, I don't know, I just think it was a lot more common than people know. And it just, you know, I think that in every city, including Marion, there were houses of ill repute and all that stuff, and it was just, you know, I think a lot of women didn't want to be pregnant all the time, and so there was a lot of abstinence, and I think it was a really different time. There was, you know, no really good birth control other than not having sex, and so I just think it was much more common than we all know about.
It comes back to where we started. Even though it is 1920, 1905, 1919, all these things going on, he was a newspaper man. He understood that things like that could be printed. The letters were evidence. I think, well, we know he wrote them to Carrie. We think he wrote them to Nan. I think he knew he had had the baby. I mean, we didn't exactly have paternity tests, but, you know, there it went.
Yep.
Boy, oh boy, he made a... If he had lived, I mean, I don't think he knew he was dying for too long before he died. What did he think was going to happen once he was out of office? I mean, that would have been a nightmare.
It sure would. And, you know, it's funny. He, I think he always knew that Florence would predecease him. And so that was going to solve that problem. And in fact, she, you know, she dies a year after he does. So there's, he had reason to think that. So I think that that would have solved that problem. And then the Carrie versus, Nan question would have been just unbelievably complex and complicated, and I think the fact that he was so reckless about these relationships, who knows what he would have done with either one of them after he's out of office, if he lived that long and his wife had predeceased him. Who knows which one he would have selected. You would tend to think that the woman who has a child would be more likely for him to you know, attach himself to, but who knows?
It's very strange because Carrie Phillips lives here in Marion until 1960. Now Nan goes off to California, then I think up to Oregon. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's just very 1950s come along, and Carrie never 30 years after the death, she never says a word in her lifetime. The right. Letters aren't found until she dies. She didn't burn them. Maybe that was, you know, her leverage. But in the 50s, would it have really meant anything if they wanted to put her in jail in the 50s?
Or was I don't think so. I think she just, at that point, she'd put them in her, you know, it's one of those things like, you know, when do you go up to your attic and look at what you've got? I mean, I think she just kind of kept them. She had no reason to get rid of them. And then I do think, Scott, there's evidence that towards the end of her life, she was suffering from some sort of senility. Clearly, the one guy who goes to see her that writes about it seems to suggest that she was pretty vacant at that point.
You believe that Carrie Phillips was paid hush money because she makes a threat.
Right.
Do you believe Nan Britton was ever paid anything?
I bet so, and especially with the child. And I wouldn't be surprised that the family also paid her some stuff with, I think one of the sisters, at least, maybe Carolyn, was sympathetic to her. Who was her teacher? One of them was her teacher.
Yeah, that's right. One of them.
And so and my understanding is that she was sympathetic to Nan. And whether she believed her or not, I think she probably did provide her with some money. I think the George Harding family was very much against her, and I doubt they provided her with money, but... the sisters might have.
You know, a will is not read until you die, and it's my understanding that President Harding updated his will about 2 months before he died. Now, I don't know if he was ill. I guess we don't really know. But he doesn't make provisions for either one of these women, and we all can say that in June of 1923, he knew he had a daughter. He knew if Carrie Phillips is the love of his life, she's still alive.
Right.
Why doesn't, even for the daughter, why did he do nothing?
Because I think that his feeling was that this was going to remain very private and personal to him, and he was going to do it in some different way. You know, when you write a will, it goes through probate and it becomes public. I think, you know, whether there was some thought on his part for making a separate provision for either one of them outside of his will, who knows? But he wasn't going to put it in a will at that point because I'm sure he just didn't want this to come out. But I don't know whether he thought enough about how close he was to his own death. I mean, he knew he was having trouble breathing and chest pains and all that stuff, but he also had been surviving through all of it, so he maybe just didn't think he was imminently going to die.
With all this tangled web, when we get to Nan Britton, we think Florence knew about Carrie Phillips. Do you think she knew about the child?
I bet not, but I'd have to go back and look at all my stuff to say for sure about whether she had an inkling, but I bet not.
So you think one day, though, we might see the Nan Britton letters, that there might be something still out there to this story?
I don't know what that family has, and my thought is that if they had letters, we would have seen them by now. That, you know, why hold them back? Unless they are somehow thinking they want to write a book or want to make a movie or something like that and want to keep them to themselves until that happens. I just don't think that's going on. I think that they've got a lot of trinkets and other things that are memorabilia type stuff, but I'm not convinced they're letters.
So in the end, the reason this whole conversation came up last week was because of President Trump's little affair here. Are there parallels, big parallels between the two, Harding and Trump?
There are in terms of their promiscuity. But there are no parallels between them in terms of their fitness for office and their knowing about the government and understanding the government, how it works, and the way they apply themselves. I mean, Warren Harding knew the government. He had been in state government. He had been a senator through an extremely important time in our history through the war. And he was very thoughtful about everything he did from a government standpoint. And he was trained for the job. I mean, Trump has no training other than real estate and being a celebrity on TV, and that's showing. I mean, Harding worked his head off. One of the reasons he died young was he just worked and worked and worked. And I think, you know, Trump golfs and golfs and golfs. There's no comparison between the two men in terms of what they applied to the office.
Two quick questions here with 2 minutes left. Carrie Phillips lived during World War II. Was she involved in that war as well with Germany?
I doubt it, but you're testing my memory. I'd have to go back and see what has been written about that time period. Obviously, the letters I looked at didn't go through that period, but my guess is that she probably was still very pro-German, and I think I have a recollection of her saying pro-German things even during World War II, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if she was not only pro-German but even pro-Nazi at the time, and she was very radically sympathetic with Germany.
Mm. And in the end, why do you tend to believe that Harding did pay hush money?
Because there's a letter where they talk about it, and where he offers her to pay this money. And says, please don't, you know, do the thing that's going to blow us all up. Literally to almost to that extent. And then she doesn't blow him up. So I think the money was paid.
Oh, and this would have been in the 20s?
This would have been 1920, yeah.
Wow. Isn't that interesting? That's fascinating.
Yep.
Jim, it's always a fascinating conversation. I can't thank you enough for coming on. And because the more we talk, the more you learn. The books and the things. History is a very interesting thing.
Yeah, and we're going to have to talk about my new book that's just about to come out, too, here at some point in one of your programs.
Absolutely. Let me know when it comes out, and we'll have you back on. Thank you, Jim.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jim Robinault. Hey, stay tuned. We got more coming up.
Lovely fire.
I will
do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. We're talking, and I keep going.